Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 3 of Slamhammer, Australian Warhammer 40k and Kill Team Podcast. My name is Will of Crossblade Studios, and I'll be your host. Before we jump into the substantive part of this episode, I just want to say a massive thank you from the bottom of my heart to everybody who has jumped on their favorite listening platform, whether that's Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Anchor.fm so far, and listen to the podcast. I was checking some of the statistics for the podcast this morning, and it is great to see that there is a growing listener base in Australia and also some listeners internationally. As someone who has been in the hobby for around about 20 years and loves just talking about all things hobby and all that sort of thing, it is deeply rewarding and hugely gratifying to see that there has been support for the podcast. And if you would like to support the podcast, the best way to do that right now is to send your feedback. As someone who's very open to the feedback process, it is hugely important to me that viewers' voices and thoughts and feelings and interests are accounted for. So if you would like to submit your feedback on how this podcast could be continually improved, please do feel free to do so. The various ways you can do that is via the voice messaging link on the anchor.fm profile, via Instagram, where you can find us at Crossblade Studios, or via email at crossbladestudios@gmail.com. This episode extends the 101 conversation that we started in episode 2. Whereas episode 2 was talking about the basics of designing a character to meet an aesthetic and then how you go about building that, this episode continues that narrative into painting. So the first place we'll be touching off in part one is the basics of color theory, so you can take into account some considerations when thinking about how you're going to paint a model to meet your desired aesthetic. Part two would talk about the basics of all the tools, such as brushes and palettes, and other accessories that might be helpful for you when you start the painting process. And part three will be a guided walkthrough of the painted process from undercoating to painting, washing, highlighting, and basing. If you are experienced in the hobby and you are an experienced painter, then this is an episode for you to pick up pointers throughout the painting process. And if you do have anything that you would like to share or any tips of your own, then please feel free to send them through. If you are new to the hobby or if you've never painted a miniature before, this is a great episode for you to get a guided walkthrough of painting from start to finish. And with no further ado, we're going to jump to part one, the basics of color theory. Hello and welcome back to this part one of episode three of Slamhammer. In this part one of this episode, we're going to be talking about something which is very fundamental and basic to the entire painting process and to creating any visual art project in general, and that is color theory. And color theory is important because it underpins the entire way in which humans interact with the world, essentially, and perceive it. So if you think about people who are colorblind, the reason why they cannot perceive the world the same way that the rest of us may can be tied directly back to color theory. And also, the same reason why your inkjet printer might argue with you when it is low on cyan ink is another reason why it is very difficult to understand color theory without going back to the basics. Color theory, fundamentally, is a term which describes the interaction of color and visual light. And for all the colors that we can perceive in the world, there are three very basic ones, which are essential building blocks for the rest. And that is red, yellow, and blue. And the colors red, yellow, and blue are ones that you will often see if you think back to when photos were developed from film, you would often see these colors in the logos of the services which would be doing that development process for you. And that is because these are the three most basic colors through which other colors are perceived. So when you have your very basic inkjet printer and it is running low on blue, cyan color, and you try to print and it says, nope, can't do it. And the reason why it can't do that is because an entire section of the visual light spectrum becomes unavailable to it. So an inkjet printer becomes incapable of perceiving or determining how to combine visual light through ink to then create the image you might want. And the reason why, in a similar way, even if you're out of black ink in that same inkjet printer, the printer can still attempt to create a color which is like black, is because the color that we perceive as black is the absorption of all visual light. The color that we perceive as white is the reflection of all visible light. So through combining all of the colors that it can perceive through the different inkjet tanks, it can create something which is similar to black. But without one of those primary colors, it can't create any other color because it gets confused. And when you start to break down these primary colors and combine them a little bit, we get what's called a secondary color. And a secondary color includes things like your purples, your oranges, and your greens. And for those who are aware of color blindness, you would then understand that there is a trouble for people with color blindness in differentiating colors such as reds and your greens. And that can impact their entire world experience. And the reason why red and greens are the ones that are creating the problem is that they're actually on opposite ends of the visual light spectrum. So red is a polar opposite of green, and that's called a complementary color. So when these two colors complement each other well, they help us perceive depth and shape in a way which we actually need as humans to go about our day-to-day lives. So when you think about someone who might have color blindness at the supermarket, and they're in the fresh produce section, they're trying to determine what constitutes a ripe fruit from an unripe fruit. And if you cannot potentially distinguish between the colors red and green, then for many of these fresh vegetables or fruits, you actually can't make that determination, because a typical unripe fruit or unripe vegetable, when you exclude things like your root vegetables, such as things like potatoes or other legumes, if they cannot distinguish between the colors red and green, then it becomes harder for those people to determine which of these particular vegetables they're looking for is ripe based on color. And as humans, this has a strong evidentiary link back to when we were foragers, right? So you take that becomes a big problem. And you think, well, how does this actually relate to painting at all? And it's because when we're thinking about the different ways that we create color, you can take these primary colors, your blues, your yellows, and your reds, and then you break them down into your secondary colors. So you get your blue, green, yellow, orange, red, and purple. And you'll notice that a lot of these colors are actually the ones that are represented in the Codex Astartes company markings. So when you start to break down the Ultramarines, for example, their veteran company has white as their shoulder pad trim. Their second company has yellow, a primary color. Their third company has red, another primary color. But then when you get to the fourth company can't have blue because the rest of the arm is already blue. So the fourth company is black, if I recall correctly, and then it goes green. And then you go into the reserve companies, and the reserve companies have these combinations of secondary and tertiary colors, which combine those colors together again. So there's actually a very strong reason as to why the Codex Astartes sets out the colors those ways, and it's because they're strongly complementary to one another, being on the same combination of highly complementary primary, secondary, or tertiary colors. And when you're going about painting a model, you might have something which is bright and vibrant, or you might have something which is darker in its look. So let's take the ultramarine as an example again. So when you have an ultramarine and you want to paint, let's say, the shoulder pad rim, and you're thinking about the colors that you want to start with. And let's assume for this moment that we're using a light base coat, so something which is already reflecting visual light and is very, very open to the receipt of more color. Okay, so you might have underpainted your model with Corax White or Wraithbone. Okay, so if you start off with a very bright yellow as your shoulder pad rim, it is much harder to create a effect of highlighting to show a variation in color across the spectrum than if you start with a darker yellow and gradually build your way up. So for example, you might use a color which is almost close to an orange as your base coat, and then through a number of layers you might build that up to a very bright yellow. And depending on what interpretation of the ultramarines you have, a lot of the time the second company actually has gold shoulder pads, shoulder pad rims. So you start that process from almost a brown color or a bronze color, because that absorbs a lot of the visual light. And then you start building up to the top gold, almost silver color, which starts to reflect gradually more and more light, which is why they're visually striking shoulder pads and shoulder pad rims when they're done in a way which allows for that variation in absorption and reflection of the visual light in the visual light spectrum. Okay, so when you take something like a gold shoulder pad, and that gold shoulder pad, let's say for the purposes of this example, has a eagle on it, and you painted that a strong gold color, but in that is a reef. So you decide to paint that reef green, because that is the way that you would normally perceive a reef, whether that's olive branch or whatever else. The reason why the green will tie in really well with that gold that you've just painted is because they represent a similar part of the visual light spectrum. And they're also called, when you delve into color theory, analogous colors. And an analogous color is any three colors, which is side by side on a color wheel. So yellow and green, yellows, yellow, orange. When you start to move apart from sort of the green side or the red side. So you get that variation between the two. And when you put these two colors together, it works. Okay. But one of those colors is normally stronger than the others. So your gold color is going to be stronger than your green, because the gold color is reflecting more light in the visual light spectrum. So it will stand out more to your eyes. And that's just how your eyes perceive that color. Okay. But the opposite is also true. So when you think about something like a highly unusual camouflage pattern, okay, you might have something which is, let's say, a Drukhari armor plate, which combines a highly striking visual scheme. And a highly striking visual scheme might have something like a purple and a green. And in a lot of cases, they do have those sort of purple and green hues to them. And you also see these things in Tyranids. And you might also have something like your blues and your yellows, as I was explaining in the case of the ultramarine. So if you have a complementary color, those complementary colors are colors which are on the opposite sides of a color wheel or a visual light spectrum. Okay, so if you take the case of the Drukhari armor, the purple, which you might use as your base coat for all of your Drukhari armor, is not going to resound as much as a green highlight or any green shape or pattern which you use to break that up. And that is because your greens are on a visible end of the light spectrum, which is opposite to the purples. Okay, so when you perceive nature, nature is a great way to observe complementary colors. Okay, so you might have, let's say, a rose. A rose, as we perceive it, a red rose, incorporates two colors which are on opposite ends of the visual light spectrum, red and a green. And red works the same way as purple does because it's next to red on the color spectrum. Okay, so when you think about how you're going to break that up, you start with a purple base color, and then you might, say, paint a camouflage shape, and that might be some kind of tiger stripe or irregular shape, something which isn't quite isometric or using right angles. And it is striking to the human eye because your eyes perceive these two colors very differently because of their position on the visual light spectrum. Okay, and where you're able to use these colors in this way, it is because a lot of these colors are actually what's called harmonious. So if you use a color spectrum which incorporates one entire half of the visual light spectrum or a color wheel, so let's say a green, a yellow, and a red, when you start to blend all those colors together, then you start to get something which is highly harmonious. And that's what you see a lot with the orcs. Orcs use a lot of harmonious colors in the normal course of events. So you get something like a green and a yellow, a green and a red, or even a green and an orange. So when you think about the orcs which use red, let's say orc trucks, because red goes faster. The reason why that works well with the green of the orcs is because they're complementary, harmonious colors. The same way, the reason why a blue and yellow ultramarine is visually striking to the human eye is because they are complementary colors. However, these are not harmonious colors, so you get a nice, strong distinction there. And whether or not that was Games Workshop's choice for picking ultramarines as the poster boys, I don't know, but that's why it works. Okay, so another important consideration in color theory is the color context. And color context describes how colors interact with one another and the shape of the colors that you're using as well. So you remember where I mentioned the Drukhari armor and using a highly irregular shape when it came to actually painting camouflage. The reason why an irregular shape is more readily able to be distinguished by the human eye than very similar shapes is because of the degree to which the human eye can make distinctions between different objects based on their shape and color. So when you think about camouflage and the way it's used in a military context, military camouflage is used to break up the shape that's behind it. Okay, so you want, let's say, a human to blend into its environment. You want to take away the distinction between the different blades of grass, for example, or different leaves on a plant, and then the human that's sitting behind it. So you need to have at least a color which blends in somewhat with its background. But then there's also a very obvious human shape, because a human wearing a uniform has a very familiar shape which your eye can readily recognize. So camouflage will often have irregular shapes or combinations of shapes such as cubes, which then form an irregular pattern. So your eyes cannot make that distinction anymore. So the two examples that you might use is a woodland camouflage versus a digital pattern camouflage. And a woodland pattern relies on breaking up the outline of a human to make it blend in with those natural shapes that you might see in nature. And a digital pattern relies on breaking up the colors which your eyes are perceiving so you can no longer make a radial distinction. Okay. And a digital pattern will use colors which do not have an enormous amount of contrast. And the reason why it does that is because when colors do not have a great degree of contrast, they begin to blend together and your eyes begin to get confused. Because again, the human eye is not very good at distinguishing objects or colors. So in this example, to demonstrate contrast in this discussion of color theory, we'll use two colors that are very close to one another on the visual light spectrum. And that is orange and red. Orange and red are right next to one another and aren't that far apart either on the visual light spectrum. So if you use these two colors in very similar ways and in very similar shapes, it is very hard for your eye to make that radial distinction. However, if you use these two colors in irregular shapes, it is more easy for your eyes to break that up because it's able to make a complete distinction between the two objects that it is observing. So if you have two cubes stacked on top of one another, one being smaller than the other, you might find that an orange is blending in very closely with a red. But if you have a circle on top of another color, it is easier for your eyes to distinguish those different colors. In another context, if you have highly contrasting colors, such as blue and red, then it is far easier, even when using similar shapes, to make that distinction because it's coming from different parts of the color spectrum and you're absorbing different degrees of visual light. The most extreme example of this, of course, is using black and white. Black, as we perceive it, is the absorption of all visible light in the color spectrum. So there's nothing left to reflect out, right? And white is the opposite. It's the reflection of all visible light in the spectrum. So when you combine either black or white with a color such as red, there is a lot of distinction that can readily be made by your human eyes, particularly against a black background, because a black background implies the complete absorption of all visual light behind the object, which has the color. However, when you use a very bright color on a white background, then sometimes it can be very hard to make that distinction. And an example of how this is used is in the white scars. The white scar space marines have white armor with a red shoulder pad rim. And it is much harder to make that visual distinction between white and red. So you'll often find that the reds on a white scar space marine are used in irregular ways and in non-complementary shapes. And in that way, they can be distinguished more readily. And finally, if you use shapes in regular ways and colors in regular ways, then your eyes can also be fooled by that. So, for example, a darkish blue and a lightish purple can appear to be almost the same. However, if you put these colors together in a way which is so similar, your eyes can then begin to get them completely confused to the extent that a new color is perceived. And that is called color stability, because your eyes begin to get more and more confused when they perceive these two colors together. So the way in which this works really well is in pearlescent paint. And pearlescent paint is often used when painting Alpha Legion Chaos Space Marines. And this works for them because depending on where you're perceiving the model and in which way you're perceiving the model, these can look very different. So from one perception, you might be looking at a purple model, and from another perception, from a different direction, you might be perceiving a green model. And this works really well for them because the Alpha Legion is based around this deception and fooling whoever they're dealing with. However, if you're using something like an ultramarine, then that confusion of color doesn't really work. It's kind of hard to make that distinction. So the way that you do break up those colors, so for example, if you're using one of the Space Marine Reserve companies for the ultramarines and they have those purple shoulder pad rims and blue armor, the way that you enhance that distinction between the two is through highlighting, making further adjustments along the visual light spectrum to darken, say, your blues, which are your base color, and to lighten the purples, which are your raised colors, which would normally be on the shoulder pad rims. And through doing that, you can counteract the fooling of your eyes by introducing more visual light into one part of the spectrum and reducing the visual light in the other. So then you have a ready distinction between the two, and then your model stands out. Finally, on the use of black, and because I paint Death Watch, when you start to introduce hues, then you can get another separate effect. So a lot of the painting tips with Death Watch will include having a blue hue in your highlights. And a hue represents a gradual transition or gradient of color. If you follow the traditional guide of painting the Death Watch, then introducing those blues also helps to create that distinction between two parts of the visual light spectrum. So when you start from a black color, you start to lighten gradually towards white as the edge of the armor grows higher and higher. By putting a blue in there, you're able to more readily create a distinction because your eyes also get to perceive another color in that visual light spectrum. So if you have a dark black, then a blackish blue, then a blue, and then say a white, your variation from black to white is much more vast and can look a lot more vibrant because there are more aspects of that color wheel and the visual light spectrum that your eyes are perceiving at the one time. So if you want the bright and vibrant marine that has black armor, then introduce blue through your painting process so as to create that hue or gradient in the color that you're using. However, if you want a darker and more grim-looking marine that doesn't have those hues, then you stick to your greys. So with my Death Watch, I stick to the greys and silvers because I don't want that brightness coming out, and I want the human eye to perceive the blackness and the grey because it represents the dark and the grim. And that represents two very different ways of painting your blacks to achieve two very different visual results. So consider in this context how you would paint an Imperial Guard miniature or Astra Militarum Catachan. You can paint the greens and the reds, and you have two very distinct colors. Or you might decide to paint something akin to, let's say, a US Navy SEAL that you might have perceived on the internet with a lot of greens. So starting from a very dark green to a light green. The former model has much more contrast, so it's able to be distinguished more readily across the model. However, the latter has no such contrast or very little contrast, so it all starts to blend together. And when you consider how those two models operate, you might want to have a very classic looking Catachan, which can be very obviously recognized. However, if you want something to represent an elite jungle fighter, which doesn't want to be seen, consider the less contrast. If you want your Tyranids to represent a very natural look, use warm colors that sit on the one side of the visual light spectrum and the same part of a color wheel, because it will look more natural and blended together. If you want to have quite loud contrast, use opposite ends of the color spectrum and the same color wheel, such as, say, a purple and a green, or a yellow and a blue, or a let's say, green and a red. And the same goes for the orcs. If you want to paint your bad moons, you'll have a different color choice to your flash gits. And they're deliberately designed that way to catch light in different ways. So when you consider those colors together and you have a strong think, very considered think, about how much light you're looking to capture and what theme is being reflected in those selection of colors, then you can go about collecting your paints that you need and sitting down to get started. This segment has been a 101 on color theory and how that applies to painting models. After the break, we're going to talk about the basic tools and techniques that you will need when painting. So that includes a selection of brushes, color palettes, and other accessories. And then after that segment, we'll have a guided walkthrough of painting a model from start to finish. So I'm going to take a quick break and we'll be back with painting basics right after this. Hello and welcome back to part two of this episode three of Slam Hammer, where we're talking about painting basics. And for some of you, this won't be anything new. However, for those who are newer to the hobby or perhaps want to pick up some more tips along the way, this is, of course, very helpful in knowing what kind of tools and equipment might be helpful for you if you're delving into or looking to improve your painting over time. So much like episode two, where I provide a bit of a list of tools that are helpful for anybody in the hobby, I'll be doing the same thing in this part of this episode, to basically go over all the tools and techniques that I kind of use and what might help you improve those techniques. Because obviously the better tools you have to help you in painting models, the better off you'll be, of course, when that is coupled with good practice over time. And the first, fairly obviously, will be brushes. So there are a variation of brushes that you can get from Games Workshop, and for those experienced in the hobby, again, this won't be anything new. However, finding the right brush for you is something that's really helpful, I've found, because you tend to become comfortable with a type of brush and you begin to use that brush for a whole range of things, not just what the side of the brush suggests. So for me, the Games Workshop fashion brush, which actually does a really great job, is first the small basing brush and then small layer brushes. And these are some really good quality brushes that are just the right size and right breadth of tip, I guess, to really flex across your basing, for one, but also some of the small to medium-sized details on a lot of the miniatures which I'm painting, which for the majority of time will be Space Marines. So small and medium base and layer brushes are really great for those really basic painting tasks, because they tend to really hold paint very well and allow you to flex between some medium and small details on a lot of your miniatures. And for the most part, particularly when you're painting Space Marines, given the different stylistic elements of those miniatures, these would be really good. And for the finer details, I have two brushes, and that is a small and extra small artificer layer brush from Citadel as well, and those are fantastic for those. And I couple all of my basing brushes with the medium shade brush, again, from Citadel, because if you want to cover a large area of model or a large area of a base, having a larger tip on a brush which is obviously designed for that purpose works really well. For those who perhaps don't use Citadel brushes, and there's bound to be a few out there, there are a number of different brush shapes and sizes which work really well for you. And one set of brushes which I have that would perhaps work quite well for people and have a number of different features to them which are very appropriate for miniature modeling are called Montmartre Mini Detail Brushes. It's a Tacklon brush set, and there's five different brushes in this set here, including one angled brush. And these flex between shaders and spotters or very small details. And the reason why these brushes are really good is they have super fine points on them. And the great thing about the majority of these super fine points, with the exception of the shader, is that when you're working on details, kind of like what I mentioned with the green stuff working tools, having the right size tool and having the right shape tool makes the whole painting task a hell of a lot easier. So if you're trying to work around some details that are on awkward angles, using a long straight paintbrush might make that task a little bit more difficult. However, using these Montmartre brushes, which include some angular features, that becomes a lot easier. So the next part of any painter's repertoire, I feel, needs to be the palette. And for a lot of you, you'll be picking up the Citadel palette, which is simply a sheet of paper book. Sheet of pages, and it's fairly high gloss, and that is fine for most purposes. However, this is great when the conditions are right, and when it's not, I feel that the paint which I'm applying dries out on the palette a bit too easily. So one way which you can counteract this is to get a wet palette. And a wet palette is something that you can buy or you can fashion yourself. So obviously a wet palette is going to be more aligned to its particular purpose. However, with a wet palette, if you're applying a lot of the same color in a way which requires a lot of fine details, a wet palette can be fashioned out of some Tupperware, a very ordinary looking dish sponge, not the ones with the nylon scourers on the back, and with some paper towel. And allowing for enough water to sit inside that sponge and inside the Tupperware to allow for saturation on the paper towel allows for you to fashion your own wet palette, which keeps the paint wet. And that's really good if you're usually working with paint that requires application in relatively fine ways. So a good example of that is with Lord of the Rings miniatures. Because they're smaller, a lot of their details are much finer, and I find that having a wet palette means you're not constantly going back and forth and wetting your brush and trying to adjust everything really constantly. So palette, whether that be a wet or dry palette, is really important. At the moment, I'm mostly using my paper palette, even though I'm finding that my paints dry out a little bit too quickly. It's just a matter of going back and making sure your paint mixtures or combinations are appropriate for what you're working on. So for the most part, when I'm painting my Death Watch, it's a combination of a lot of blacks, a lot of silvers, and some other chromatic colors, together with the brighter colors that you use on chapter shoulder pads where relevant. And the paper palette is fine for most of those most of the time, even though it requires a little bit more work here and there depending on the atmosphere. Painting handles. If you don't own a Citadel painting handle or one made by a third party, do run out and get one. Painting handles coupled with either a miniature which is glued to one of your black bases or blue tacked to a base is something I swear by. Being able to get to all the different details more readily and not stress out your hands has really dramatically improved my painting, I guess, because it's not requiring you to hold on to a miniature really awkwardly, and it just allows for you to hold a miniature at an angle without requiring your hands to do too much. So there are a number of different sizes. I have a number of the 32 to 40 millimeter handles. So anything that can hold a small miniature right up to a Terminator on a 40 millimeter base. I have a number of these, probably will be buying another one just because they've made a great difference to me working with my miniatures. And yeah, I think if you can line up a few different miniatures and hot swap between them when you're working without having to pull them in and out and all that sort of thing, that's also really handy to improving your painting performance. So the third aspect of straight tools that you need is paint cup. Nothing particularly special about the paint cup, either Citadel 1, depending on who you watch in your tutorials, they might be using mugs or the Citadel paint cups, but you know, given that they're so obvious in their use, I'm not going to dwell on the issue of paint cups any further than necessary. However, one tool which you probably don't use a great deal, particularly when it comes to pattern work, is masking tape. Masking tape is great when you're working with larger miniatures or vehicles, because just like painter's tape, it allows you to block out details that you don't want paint to reach. In the same way, if you are working with a miniature and you want to block off a section or even half the model, so if you like to quarter or half your Marines, for example, masking tape can be a useful tool in that endeavor. And when you're using this, it's really handy to have, particularly when it comes to quartering. And the great reason why I like using masking tape for quartering is with a scalpel, it's really easy for you to divide this up into squares, particularly when you use a grey lead and a ruler. So you get a nice grid pattern, you lay it all out, and then you just paint a section, pull off the tape, paint a section, pull off the tape, paint a section, pull off the tape. It's really too easy. So if you are interested in things like check patterns, do make sure you use that. And finally, when it comes to tools, I think I would be remiss in not mentioning a paint range. I use just Citadel paints. However, there are different ranges out there which are good for different things. So things like Vallejo, Color Rangers, or Army Painter. If you want to see how some of these work, I would very highly recommend looking at Duncan Rhodes's Painting Academy on YouTube, where a number of these different paints are used in his demonstrations. Mostly because I can't speak to the value of the others. Citadel paints are usually fine, even if a lot of the paints that are perhaps in the chromatic or metallic ranges require a bit more shaking, and things like whites and all that sort of thing due to the level of pigment perhaps need a little bit more attention than what one would otherwise, you know, be bothered with. And I've worked with a very large Citadel color range back from, your very, very old Citadel. Not quite the angled shape pots, but certainly the old range, which included things like foundation paints and the metallics range and all that sort of thing. So I've seen a lot of these paints and how they work, and I would simply try to get a good range of colors, all the range of features which you're trying to cover off. So for example, if I'm trying to paint my reds, I have things like my corn red, which is my base color depending on what I'm working on. So with a red company marking on a Death Watch Marine's right knee pad, I start with a base of corn red. And that is a great base color just for painting a very light colored line. I'll speak more to that in the next section of this tutorial. Whereas something like a Mephiston red, which has a slightly different shade, I use for robes, depending on, of course, the color I'm looking for. When you move up to your next layer, then Evil Sun Scarlet, a great layer paint, is really good for that, just to give it a bit more vibrancy. However, obviously, as you start moving from a base paint up to a layer paint, then the level of pigment changes. So making sure you've got the right combination of paint and water, for example, or if you're combining it with something like Alamian Medium, making sure your combinations are right is really handy for that. And finally, what I would use for my final layer highlights for a lot of my reds is Wild Rider Red. Sorry. Wild Rider Red is a very light colored orange. It almost has a bit of a pink hue to it. And if I'm working with pink colors, this will often be combined with another sort of purpley or pinkish shade for a base. But certainly for highlighting the very tips of red, Wild Rider Red is fantastic. And by way of contrast, if I'm working with purples, purples, depending on the depth, they tend to be quite darkish and blue at their base. So if I'm working with a very dark purpley color, I might work with Nagaroth Knight as my base and gradually build that up in combination with Xeris Purple, and then finally combine Xeris Purple with Emperor's Children as my final highlights. So you have almost a pinkish purple color at the end there. And it becomes a process of learning and application to determine what works best for you. However, I think that for the most part, if you're being really savvy with your color range and understanding color theory as well and how these other colors work well next to one another, you can get some really excellent results. The final thing I just want to touch on in this segment was on things like Artis Opus brushes. I do own some Artis Opus brushes, the Zero series, and they're extremely fine detail brushes, which I use for the very finest of detail work. And they come with brush soap. When you're working with brushes and you're working with fine detail, having a good conditioned brush that is well maintained is really key. Soaking your brushes and making sure that you're using them well and cleaning them at the end of each session is also really important so they don't begin to fray. When you begin to have frayed brushes, they become useful for other things like dry brushing. However, I would stress that before buying something like Artis Opus, unless you're doing very fine detail work, have a think about the way which you are using your brush and whether you're giving it the due care that it requires. Because reinvesting in brushes over and over when you need to be giving your existing brushes more care can perhaps be a handy way to conserve your budget too. I, for the most part, will use my Games Workshop brushes for the majority of my Death Watch Marines. And when it comes to client work, that's when I work outside of a strictly Citadel range, because some details require some finer brushes. And while there's nothing wrong with the majority of my Games Workshop brushes or brushes from other ranges, I just feel like some of the finer points which are available in some of the other ranges are more appropriate for those projects. However, if you do have the budget and you want to lash out on some Artis Opus brushes, without this being a plug, they are very good. They come with brush soap, or if you just want to invest in some brush soap, make sure you're giving your brushes TLC so they don't fray. Finally, and kind of like what I was saying with the other modeling tools, working with appropriate amounts of light is really handy, as well as a good amount of air circulation for the right atmosphere. When you're working with fine detail, fundamentally what you're trying to do is capture different parts of light hitting a model at a different angle. And when you lose light, it becomes far more difficult for you to understand what a reflection should look like, for example. So if I'm holding this Inquisitor Demon Hunter, I can clearly see after taking to it with my Dremel that there are a number of different details down here which require some fixing with green stuff. And then once I have applied all the different parts I'm using this modeling project, there'll be definitely some very different parts of this model where the light will be hitting, and there'll be other parts which are quite well concealed. Those small details and understanding how the light hits is always better when there is an abundance of light. trying to work around different light balances when you are already losing light or struggling with light is always going to make a modeling or painting project a hell of a lot harder. So make sure you get a good amount of light. Invest in a good LED work light. If you're likely to be working at night or in some subpar conditions as far as lighting is concerned, I do need to replace my desk lamp. So at the moment, I'm painting during the day. However, as soon as it hits, say, 4 o'clock or 4:30, even though there is enough light for me to see a model and pick out most details, I typically put my paintbrushes down because you can be working against yourself if you're working on fine details and you just don't have the light balance there to make the best of those efforts. And circulation as well, and that creates your atmosphere. When you're working with paints, particularly water-based acrylics, they are susceptible to evaporation. And ensuring that you're getting a good light balance and air balance is really helpful in ensuring that you're either getting the right amount of liquid to stay in your paint so you don't have to constantly dilute and reapply, or if you're using a wet palette, it can be useful to have a good amount of air so that that doesn't stagnate, particularly if you're not rinsing out and changing that wet palette too often. So light balance, air balance, both very important. Making sure you have good tools to emphasize your painting, also very key, but also just practicing. There'll be a walkthrough of a painting method in the third part of this episode. However, I do want to emphasize that when you're starting out with painting, or even if you've been doing it for a while, the hardest part is improving substantially. And you'll see on social media some really fantastic pieces of work, and you think, well, how can I possibly do something which is as good as person X or Y? Don't worry so much about what person X or Y is doing, because practice makes perfect, as the old adage goes. But often when you're trying to fix or correct or improve parts of your painting technique, spending time with a model which doesn't mean much to you, or it might be a part of a model, or it might even be a piece of sprue, to practice your techniques can be really handy. Because if you're thinking about painting something to a high quality standard, be it for a campaign or even just for your personal use, especially if you're not painting for something like Golden Demon, if that's still being run in your country, putting too much pressure on yourself can also interfere with your concentration, and you might take what is really a progressive step in your painting quite negatively if it doesn't quite match what you're looking for. Think critically about what you're hoping to achieve with each of your painting methods, and then be reasonable with yourself about the outcome. And I'll give you an example. I've been working with the more classic painting techniques since I started painting back in the year 2000, and I've not used contrast paints for much other than shaders since they came out, and I've not had any formal contrast paint tutorials since these paints came out. So contrast paints aren't very good for me when they come to modeling, because I just don't have the practice. Despite all the work I've done with the other paint range, they do apply differently to your models, and there's a different technique that applies. So with my Angels of Redemption that I'll be painting when I take a break from my Death Watch very shortly, they will be used alongside the contrast paint range. And the reason why I'm doing that is not only to take advantage of some different rules in Kill Team, but also to give me an opportunity to try some different techniques when it comes to painting. So none of my work with my Death Watch will be impacted because I'm not working on them. And you can place more or less stock in anything that you're doing. And for me, Angels of Redemption will apply a very different aesthetic because they're much brighter, let's say Space Marine Kill Team, than the Death Watch are. They have a quartered or halved painting technique, depending on which part of the model you're painting. And I'll certainly be making use of those opportunities as well, together with masking tape, to practice different parts of painting models with contrast paint. It might be the case that I'll start out with that, and I might find a bit of a struggle to get the result I'm looking for. But if you don't take yourself too seriously and you focus on what you're doing and you critically evaluate how you've gone without being too hard on yourself, then improving your painting outcomes is always going to be an iterative and constant process. So what I would really emphasize, if you're learning to do something that's new, is not take yourself too seriously, but always be open to opportunities for improvement as well. And that includes asking others for help, because there is a whole community out there who you can ask for tips. Same way with modeling. And I'd very much encourage everybody to reach out to them if you ever have a question about modeling or painting and how you can improve either aspect of your hobby. I'm going to take a break from here. When we come back, I'll go through a walkthrough for painting a basic Deathwatch Marine, and that will be a slightly different approach to that in Duncan Rhodes' previous tutorial for Warhammer TV, but we'll arrive at a very similar result. So I'll take a break now, we'll come back, and we'll talk about painting a basic Deathwatch Marine. Hello, welcome back to part three of this painting basics tutorial, episode three of Slamhammer. On this part three of Slamhammer, I just want to touch on some painting basics. And in this section of this tutorial of sorts, we're going to go over a walkthrough of painting a basic Deathwatch Marine. And as I was saying before we jump to the break, this is going to turn out a little bit differently to the tutorial of Duncan Rhodes, which was on YouTube for Warhammer TV. So if you're looking for a marine that has a bluish hue, then I'd very strongly recommend having a look at that. Also, because there's much higher production value for what you're looking for compared to a podcast, which is just in its first season. However, the benefit of listening to a podcast is that you don't have to take your eyes off what you're doing. And if that's what you're looking for, then that's fantastic too. So if we take the very basic Deathwatch Marine and you want to start painting it, one of the really key design decisions that you're going to need to make is, well, what chapter is my Deathwatch Marine going to be? For this tutorial, my marine is from the Minotaurs, and the Minotaurs compared to the Brazen Minotaurs, depending on how you decide to iterate or imagine those marines, they have white shoulder pads with the black bull motif. So the different accents which are in the model will reflect that aesthetic. So when you've undercoated your model with Chaos Black, do make sure you get a nice full coverage. Having a nice painting platform for that is really useful. So what I use for my base coating of my miniatures is either my painting handles, or I will use an outdoor area combined with what is an upside down barbecue or baking tray. And that allows me, depending on how many models that I'm trying to undercoat, of course, to maneuver undercoat spray can around a large number of models and get nice full coverage. Because one of the worst things about undercoating Warhammer miniatures is finding out part of the way through your painting process that you've missed a spot. And what I would encourage is to use either something like that or something which is nice, cheap, and disposable that you can either flip around or turn around. It might be a Lazy Susan type scenario where you can rotate your painting platform, or if you're using something like an airbrush, which is outside the scope of this tutorial, making sure you're using every model angle available to get good paint coverage. So let's say that you've been able to undercoat your model and it's got a nice thin layer, because you don't want too thick either, of Chaos Black. What you need to do next is paint over the entire model again with watered down Abaddon Black. And the reason why you do that is because Abaddon Black and Chaos Black dry slightly differently. So if you intend on going over mistakes, then you need to allow for correction with a consistent color of paint. And using Abaddon Black to go over again and get a nice thin layer is a much better idea than having blotchy blacks, which don't quite match up with one another. So going over your first layer with Abaddon Black allows for a nice, consistent coverage in the event you need to go back and fix something up on your model along the way. After that, much like Duncan Rhodes' tutorial, I use a first layer highlight of Eshin Grey, and an Eshin Grey highlight is going to be quite dark, and as soon as you're building up your layers, as the name suggests, you start off with a first level highlight, which is much darker, and progressively increase the light levels. So Eshin Grey, you just want to capture all the high edges of your model. And I wouldn't be too obsessed with getting that right, because at your first highlight level, typically they're dark enough that, you know, if you've made a little mistake and the highlight's a little bit thick, it shouldn't be so bright that it stands out, obviously. But if you do make mistakes that you want to go back and correct, go over and cover that up with your Abaddon Black, sorry. And you approach the model where you're picking out all the high edges. So on a Primaris Marine that has those hip plates, it's quite easy to angle your brush along those hip plates, just pick out all the outer edges. And what I also do for mine is I cover the rear of the legs in the same way, angling your brush and making sure you're capturing all those in a very basic way. So what you should have is a nice coverage on the model with some very lightly applied highlights, which just start to bring out the edges just that little bit. And this is where Duncan and I differ in the methods, because I'm going for a more subdued tone in my Death Watch, whereas Duncan's Death Watch Marine, which he painted for Warhammer TV, was a brighter Imperial Fist. And the hues which he gets out of his result are going to differ from mine. And what I use for my next level of highlight is not Fenris Grey, but actually Dawnstone. And Dawnstone is a whiter second level highlight on the extreme edges of your miniatures, rather than something like Fenris Grey, which is quite blue. And I did try that with a few of my miniatures, and it just didn't look right to me. So tracking the same extreme edges of your model with Dawnstone allows for a nice grayscale looking marine with the extreme edges picked out, the color which is closer to white without actually being white. So you get a nice raised armor effect with that, which I'd very strongly recommend. For things like your chest eagles on your marines, what I then use to pick out any of those details is Storm Vermin Fur, in a dry brushed sort of way. And when you have picked out all the relevant details there, wash over it with Nuln oil to pick out all of the recesses, so that looks all nice and dark. And then if you wanted to pick out the details again on top of the Storm Vermin Fur, I would combine Storm Vermin Fur 50-50 with Dawnstone just to pick out some of the more extreme detail. But Dawnstone and Storm Vermin Fur are pretty similar in their shades, and you can get a pretty decent effect with just using a little bit less of your Storm Vermin Fur to get the extreme edges, particularly if you're using a decent wash. So after that, What I do with all my Marines is I paint the right knee pad. And the right knee pad is quite simple and straightforward. What you use is a medium layer brush, and you just paint a single vertical line with corn red. And after that, you do a highlight on each side with Evil Sun Scarlet. And if you make any mistakes, and it is quite possible, just go back over it with Abaddon Black. When you've got a Marine which is holding a bolt gun or bolt rifle, you may decide that you want your Marine's bolt rifle to be red. Mine are black because, again, I'm going for quite a dark theme on mine. So if you're going for a dark red, sorry, if you're going for a red theme on yours, I would again use something like corn red and then Evil Sun Scarlet for those base colors. And a base of Lead Belcher with a wash of Nuln Oil and a highlight of Ironbreaker for your steel elements. And what I use for my extreme highlights on all of my metals, and this is the same for the left arm and pauldron, which are also that steel color, is Runefang Steel. Now, one other area in which this tutorial will differ from Duncan Rhodes is that in Duncan Rhodes' tutorial, he suggests making a wash of Vlamium Medium, and I believe it was Kalidor Sky or something of that nature, to wash over the top of your metals to give it a blue hue. And the reason why you do that is because of the whole bluish steel sheen kind of aesthetic that you go for in the brighter Death Watch miniatures. However, mine correspond with the darker aesthetic, so what I use is Runefang Steel to pick out some more extreme highlights on the metals, and that will have a same sort of bright, glimmery effect without any blue tinge. And when you're doing things like power swords, it really depends on what your preference is for colors. I have a variation of colors throughout my Death Watch. For this particular Death Watch Marine, I've used a base paint of Kalidor Sky, very simply with some highlights of Teclis Blue and some Nuln Oil washes. And this was because this was just a more basic Death Watch Marine, so it didn't get any of the sort of lightning arcs throughout the middle of the blade, which I normally would paint for a more advanced project. For any of your gold elements, starting off with something like Red Tributor Armor is always a good start. And, for example, on a Death Watch Marine, the gold elements will be the special issue ammunition and some of the hilts and pommels on the power weapons. And when you apply Retributor Armor, that will come out looking like a darkish brown, goldy color. And what I use is Reichland Flesh Shade as a wash over the top of the Retributor Armor, and it will come out looking this bronzy red color almost. And that's really good if you want to represent brass. Now, brazen brass doesn't exist in the range anymore, but back in the day, this is what brazen brass did. It had a nice goldy look to it, but was also quite dark red in its tone. So it kind of did the brass thing very simply, but Retributor Armor and Reichland Flesh Shade do achieve the same goal. So when you've got your washed Retributor Armor, I pick out some of the more fine details with a layer of Liberator Gold on the extreme edges. And then again, for the most extreme edges of my miniature, I use Runefang Steel to pick out those fine details. For blues, which apply to the eyes and the lens on the Death Watch backpack, again, I'll use Kalidor Sky and Teclis Blue, together with a dot of Ceramite White or White Scar for the to represent the glimmer in a lens. However, for larger surfaces of white, and you'll see this for the left shoulder pad for your Death Watch Marines, if that's what you intend to do, like me, and the right shoulder pad for the Minotaur miniature here, using a base of Celestra Grey is fantastic for getting a nice whitish colour on your miniature to build up from there, because painting over black with Ceramite White or White Scar, it's just going to be a bad day for everyone involved. So use Celestra Grey, apply a few thin coats of that, just like our mate Duncan says, and you'll get a nice foundation for building up from there. So I tend to use two thin coats of Celestra Grey on a shoulder pad, the larger surface area, and also on the knee pad. That tends to suffice for the most part with a highlight of Ceramite White or White Scar. However, when it comes to inset details, in this case the Minotaur head, I would wash around the outside of the detail so that you can capture all that detail around the outside of horns and stuff like that without impinging on your whites, and then gradually build up with balances of Ceramite White to get a nice refined look. And finally, when it comes to your leathers, this is not entirely different from Duncan Rhodes's tutorial, but I always start off with a base layer of Gorthor Brown, which tends to apply really well even as a base. And if you need to apply a few coats of that, then fine. Gorthor Brown is fine. Then I will wash with Seraphim Sepia to get into all the edges, and I'll apply a highlight of Doomball Brown. With things like Purity Seals, again, I'll start with a base layer of Gorthor Brown, apply a wash of Seraphim Sepia, and then I will go with a layer of Xandri Dust, which is another base color, which is nice and brown, but in it's a lighter brown, I guess, and painting that in some of the folds of a Purity Seal is a good way to start demonstrating your first level highlights. And then I use a next level highlight of Yishapti Bone. And on the most extreme edges, because it is the whitest of my skin or browns, I guess, I use a touch of Flayed One Flesh to pick out the extreme edges. Finally, when it comes to painting the base, it really depends on what you've situated your miniature on, because that detail will obviously change. For me, I'm using the Sector Imperialis bases from Citadel, and they're a fairly industrial-looking base with some stone details here and there. So on that, it's just important to use Lead Belcher as the base for your metallics. But when it comes to some raised details, you may decide to get a rusty look. And what I'd use for rust, rather than messing around with a few different color combinations, is simply Doomball Brown 50-50 with Retributor Armor and watered down, because you get the brownish look and the reddish look from the Doomball Brown, which you might see if you observe rust. And then you get the sort of gold, shiny, metallic elements from the Retributor Armor. And that applies straight on, and it basically looks like it's 100% finished from that first layer. And if you do need to provide a highlight, sometimes I just do a highlight of Doomball Brown, just to pick out some of the browner elements to represent some further corrosion. And then with the metallics, after you apply the first layer, applying a wash of Null Oil will help to pick out the raised areas on some of your irons, particularly the houndstooth on some of the more industrial surfaces. And then what I use for the stone on mine, and this is going to be very different to what you might normally observe with stone, is I actually use a base of the Fang, which is a very dark blue, and then I pick out the details with Fenris Grey, and that gives a nice bluestone look. So after you've done all of that, you have the very basically painted Death Watch miniature. Some more advanced techniques involve, you know, different blending or uses of things like contrast paints to allow for shading and tonal variations in your paint. With future tutorials on painting miniatures, we'll jump to some of those more advanced techniques. But if you follow this very basic guide to painting a Death Watch Marine, then you have what is fundamentally the building blocks. One part I did actually forget to pick out is the soft armor connections on this Marine. And Skaven Blight Dinge, much like suggested by Duncan in his tutorial, is a good spot for that. However, there are some hobbyists who will pick out those details with metallics. And again, using something like a lead belcher for your basics of your soft armor, and then washing with Nuln oil will help to pick out those details. So that concludes episode 3 on some painting basics. I didn't want to dwell forever on painting basics just because it is so variable and so many different people have varying approaches depending on what aesthetics they're going for, and mine is certainly not the standard. If you did have any questions about painting or anything covered in this tutorial, and particularly what you can do to improve your own painting methods, do feel free to reach out via the voice messaging link on the anchor.fm profile, on Instagram at Crossblade Studios, or via Gmail at crossbladestudios@gmail.com. Again, and in closing, I really appreciate everybody taking the time to stop by and listen to the podcast. I greatly value your feedback and your continued listenership. And I look forward to catching you in the next episode. So thanks again, and bye-bye.